This is Leader ReadyCast, a monthly podcast featuring real-world lessons, best practices, and action-oriented insights for the you're-it moments when you're called upon to lead. Leader ReadyCast is the official podcast of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Eric McNulty, and this is Leader ReadyCast. Though COVID is barely fading in the rearview mirror, new infectious disease threats are emerging. They include avian flu, measles, mpox, and more. And this is amidst cuts to and reorganization of the nation's preparedness and response infrastructure. How ready are we? How can leaders at the state and local levels increase readiness? Where are the points of leverage that can help us prepare for and respond to the next major outbreak? This is a conversation that's happening all over the country and around the world right now. We're going to have part of it right here on Leader ReadyCast, and I'm joined today by Nikki Romanek. Romanek is a distinguished senior fellow in global health security at the Brown University School of Public Health. She most recently served as a special assistant to the president, deputy director, and chief of staff for the Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response Policy at the White House. She oversaw the federal government's domestic preparedness and response to emerging global health threats, such as the mpox and Marburg outbreaks in the DRC and Rwanda. She has deep experience in pandemic and outbreak response, policy development, and emergency management, drawing on her extensive experience leading outbreak efforts at the White House, the World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I know she's also up to some fascinating new adventures she's going to share with us now. I can't think of anyone better to discuss this with right now. How do we get ready for pandemic next? Nikki Romanek, welcome to Leader ReadyCast.
Hi, Eric. It is absolutely a pleasure and an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
I really am grateful you took some time out of your busy schedule to join us. I know you've got lots of good things to share. But before we get to now and future, let's step back a bit. How did you come to this work? How did you get your passion for public health?
So I would say two moments in my life that probably changed everything and changed the trajectory of my life going forward. I'll share just those two. So take us back to 1995 in Omaha, Nebraska. I was viewing the NAMES Project, AIDS Memorial Quilt at the Omaha Civic Center. I was 15 years old at the time. I just aged myself. but I was 15 and walking around the quilt, it was, you know, the first time that my parents had kind of let me out of the house for free and by myself solo. And walking around this quilt, not really knowing why I was there, I walked and I stood in front of this name named Ryan White. And I had seen Ryan White's name on TV. I'd seen Ryan in pictures of Elton John and Michael Jackson. And I just kind of stood there looking at his name. And it was, you know, a white panel with red letters. And before I realized it, I looked down and I had been staring at his name for 45 minutes, just thinking about everything that I knew at the time about what he had done. He was very prominent in the news when I was growing up. And, you know, watching his name there, he was the most courageous person I had ever come into contact with. I never had the privilege of meeting him, but he was the most courageous person. And I think it made me stop and think, what is courage? He was diagnosed with AIDS after a blood transfusion. He had hemophilia. And the moment after he was diagnosed and doctors told him, you know, you can go back to school. You know, this is not airborne. You're not going to get anyone sick. That's exactly what he wanted to do, was go to school and learn as much as he could for as long as he could. And immediately his school system and his city rose up against any idea of him being anywhere public. And at the age of 13 years old, he was willing to go public with having AIDS, which at the time was unheard of. And I just thought, there is no one else that is more courageous that I've ever heard of in my entire life. And I want to carry forward what he had done. It changed the entire trajectory of my career. I ended up going to Indiana University, which is where Ryan would have gone if he would have lived past graduation. He ended up passing away a week before his high school graduation. I went to Indiana. I got involved with the philanthropy that Ryan White's friend had started, IU Dance Marathon. I ended up getting grant work, got the first ever Ryan White grant at Riley Hospital for Children under his doctor, Martin B. Kleiman. I changed my major and went to medical school. I mean, it truly, really had an incredible impact in my life. So, I started my path in medical school kind of following the courage that he had. And after I went through medical school, another pivotal moment happened in 2014. I was out of school and I was working a different nonprofit at the time. I had just started one and trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. I knew that I really probably didn't want to practice medicine, but I had this degree. So as I was doing work down the street, President Obama came to CDC and he came to speak to all of these outbreak responders about the largest global outbreak to date, which we now know was the Ebola outbreak in Western Africa. And I was struck by the fact that someone that powerful and that important would actually take their time to come and thank CDC members for their hard work, and not only thank them, but highlight it for the United States and for the world to see that this matters, that this is one of the most important things that he was focusing on in his presidency. It was the first time I'd ever seen a president do something like that. It struck me in a way that I was struck in 1995, and I felt that passion in my belly once again. I applied to CDC the next day. I didn't get that job, by the way,
They
but I
still owe
kept
you. They still owe you one.
applying. Yes, they do, because I kept applying, and eventually they let me in. And it took a minute, but it doesn't matter. When I'm very passionate about something, I kind of don't stop. So eventually I did get let in. Ironically, I wanted to take that job because I wanted to be sent to West Africa the next day. I thought, I'm ready to go. Here we go, send me. Not exactly what happened. Turns out they actually put me on the domestic task force. So it was actually the opposite of what really what I thought I wanted. But that was the beginning of this career. I started in the quarantine branch, protecting our borders actually from Ebola instead of responding to Ebola in West Africa. But that led me on the path where I am now.
That's an amazing story, and I also recall the AIDS quote that didn't hit me as with it, it was I remember how powerful it was. It didn't change my life the way it changed yours, and congratulations to you for carrying that baton of courage that Ryan White handed off, and being one of the people who picked that up and carried it forward in the work that you're doing, and a lesson for everyone out there wondering how you make the impact of public health tangible. Displays like the AIDS quilt were amazingly powerful in making that very real in a very dramatic way. Touched a lot of people.
Yeah,
So,
it's incredible. And
yeah.
I've since in my career, I have met so many people who were touched in that same way by the names quilt, which has kind of been fascinating and wonderful to see.
Yeah, it really, it made something really horrible tangible for people, and you see the impact. And the many lives lost and still with us today. So as you carried your work forward, what are some of the key lessons you've learned? You've been through COVID, you've been through Mpox, you've talked about Ebola. You look at those incidents that you've been involved in. What should inform our strategies for leading future public health preparedness and response? What lessons should we make sure we have front of mind?
So, Eric, there are so many. I could go on with
We've
this
a long, very
question.
long
I will pick a
podcast.
few, and we'll go from there. First, I've learned that preparedness is the circle that never ends. You are as ready as you are prepared. Responses will always be dynamic with many unknowns and twists and turns, but the measure of your preparedness is the measure of your response. So over the last 4 years, while in the White House and before I was in the White House at CDC working on COVID, we tried very hard to leave America more prepared than when we found it. That was always the goal of the pandemic office, right? Keep preparing, and leave it better than what you found it at. That was the whole reason, that was the mission. We were truly born out of the mistakes, quote unquote, of COVID. And while we were there, we responded to Mpox Clade 2. We continued responding to Mpox Clade 2, I should say, which we had been responding to for a year prior. We responded to bird flu, we responded to Marburg, and we also responded to Mpox Clade 1, which was actually a second outbreak that happened while I was there and continues to happen, unfortunately. Everything we learned during COVID was implemented in these other responses. So what do I mean by that? All of the incredible work that started during COVID and all these innovative projects, such as RADx, which was a project that got approvals faster for different diagnostic tests, that still exists to this day. It's being kept warm. There's no funding, but it does exist. The pathways and the mechanisms that were created during COVID still exist. And RADx was used for Mpox. We have a multiplex test for Mpox that still is making its way through the process. And, hopefully within the next few months will actually be approved. Wastewater surveillance, which was a thing that nobody really knew about before COVID, it's now evolved into a way to metagenomically sequence samples and learn about so many different organisms and their full
Wow.
genome. It's incredible. It's gone from a surveillance technique where we can identify something in wastewater, which is sewage, to really one of the leading, most innovative ways surveillance can move forward. So, I mean, we've had all these tools, right? Now the point is keep them warm or keep them going. Even in this
Yeah.
climate, keep them warm or keep them going. We built a playbook, which now has more annexes than I could ever count. And we left that playbook behind. That playbook, it is the third or fourth iteration of a playbook, right? We've had a playbook before in the past. We had a playbook that Obama, President Obama, left behind that wasn't actually used during COVID. But hey, we built another one and we built out annexes for how to handle every part of an outbreak, from diplomatic communication to travel restrictions and travel advisories. So it all definitely exists there. What's a lesson that we've learned? Those are good things that we did, but what's a lesson we've learned? Well, during COVID taught the world that unfortunately, if you don't communicate properly, you lose their trust. So scientists and doctors communicate very poorly. It's kind of been known for my entire career that doctors are not the best communicators, but COVID was the moment where everybody learned that secret, unfortunately. And that poor communication led us to a trust deficit that will take decades to get out of. So we learned that we need to communicate often. We need to communicate transparently. We need to communicate what we know and what we don't know. And we need to make sure that people understand that what we're telling them may change the very next day. And we need them to know that we're providing them the information as soon as we know it. And I think that those are just basic communication skills that unfortunately was one of the biggest lessons observed. I really, truly hope that it's also a lesson that we've learned and a lesson that we can grow from. And I would just say the third thing, I call this the post-COVID lesson learned. Looking back on all of it, I learned that you have to have political will. You have to have political will from every single level in leadership. It needs to go from the person who is a pastor in a church to the local leader, mayor, to the governor, to the highest of federal government. You need to have the will of everybody behind you, believing in you and what you're doing, and supporting you in whatever way they possibly can. Without that, you don't move very far in your efforts. So those are probably the top three things I learned. I could go on, but I have a feeling you may want me to stop.
No, I think that, I mean, I could have this conversation go on all day. I think one of the things I want our listeners to take away is that when you are facing something, chances are it's not the first time it's been faced, even if it is different in its appearance. So it's a new pathogen, it's a new whatever. That doesn't mean that work hasn't been done, that there have been lessons learned that you can apply as opposed to observe. So pull open the bottom drawer on the desk and see, there might just be a plan in there, and it won't be perfect, but it'll be good enough to get you started. And a lot of things have been figured out. And I think if we could just turn our lessons learned into lessons actually put into practice, we would solve a whole lot of problems out there. But the trust one is a big one that you bring up, and I think that's a place where we've got to concentrate every single day with every interaction. To be rebuilding trust. I was just out at the NACHO preparedness conference a few weeks ago speaking, and it was one of the topics there as well. We've got to rebuild and restore, and trust is such a key component there. Because when you have trust with people, they'll go with you, they'll follow you. That's the real leadership lesson there, and they will adapt along with you. But you've got to be honest, you've got to be transparent, and you've got to be trustworthy in their eyes, which is not always easy in this environment where there's so much distrust that's been building over decades. Now, Nikki, one of the things you and I have explored before in a research context, but I'd like to talk about it here, is what leaders can do to improve coordination and communication across the federal enterprise and then between federal, state, and local health agencies, so there's a more unified response to an outbreak or to an incident. And particularly now with federal agencies taking a less assertive role, I mean, that state and local and across sector collaboration is going to become so important. What are your thoughts there from having been through, so many incidents and seeing the good, the bad, and the ugly?
So I think the most important thing that I've watched, and specifically in this time where our current environment is just so much more different than any other time before, our dynamics may have shifted, but it's not necessarily a person who has been appointed the highest coordinator of this response or that response, by the president that has to be the leader of any response. It's what we're used to for the last few years, but that's not really who leads these responses. It is part of it, and it's wonderful when that happens and it works out, and we have a COVID czar, and we have strong leadership that takes us through as a federal government. But it's not the position, it's actually the person. The communication needs to be built upon coalitions. The way that leaders really get people to follow along is they know the secret. And the secret is communication needs to come from the bottom up, not from the top down. In this current environment, I would say it's more important now that natural born leaders that exist and have existed in communities for generations upon generations, start to build these coalitions. And I know it's happening already. Build in the people who you know will lead with you in your community and do it in all the communities across the United States. You wrote a book, you've written a few, but you wrote a book, and in the book, you were it. I agree completely, that we need to share knowledge to get people along on the journey and get people to stand up, to organize and coordinate. That includes CVOs, CSOs, state, local, city, tribal, religious leadership, and much more. We need everyone to come together in a coalition type way. And we need private sector to come along the journey as well. We need not only everyone to come along the journey, but we need everyone to know about what each other is doing in the journey. If you can do that, then you are the coordinator. You don't need to be anointed or appointed. You, in fact, have become the coordinator if you can get that to happen in your community. We all have the ability to do a response that isn't federal. States have the tools, states have the leaders, states have the playbooks, and they have the knowledge. So, however, they need to convene and lead, they should do it. But they should also do it with other states. We have organizations that have already been created that do this. We have ASTO, we have NACHO. We have Big Cities Health Coalitions. We have APHA. We have APHL. We have the alphabet soup of associations that bring all of these states together and all of these different leaders together. We have IHS that brings Indian Health Service together. We need to leverage now what we already have put into place so that state level leadership can be more successful. Try and make them more successful by connecting them.
Yeah, that's such an important point you bring up, and I've already seen the formation of more regional coalitions and people, again, not waiting for permission, but just saying, let's go, let's get organized, and let's do this together. And I think the, you know, as I'm listening to you, we can always get trapped in this sort of waiting for the superhero to show up and be the quote unquote leader, when actually we've got to lead together. And the leaders, as you say, are there. I know in the doing the work on research on MPOX a couple of years ago, you know, it was those coalitions that were formed coming out of HIV/AIDS that popped right back into work and were started working together. They knew what to do, they knew the community, and they were waiting for some science, but beyond that, they knew how to communicate, they knew how to organize, and that was capacity in the system just sitting there waiting to be utilized. And I think there's more of it out there than we realize. If only we have the courage and wisdom to go activate it and just step up and start doing rather than waiting for permission.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that the coalition and the advocacy groups that rose up during MPOX, you know, I was lucky enough to work with all of them so closely, and they taught me more than probably any degree that I have right now. The wisdom and the courage that they have reminded me so much of Ryan White. They know how to do it, and they know how to do it best.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's shift gears here just a little bit. You know, one of the things that's changing a lot right now is technology, the emergence of AI. You know, we're right now teaching a course on integrating AI into crisis leadership. How do you see the role of AI and data analytics and other technological advances enhancing our pandemic preparedness and response efforts? You know, how do we make the do the most with what we've got and ensure that sufficient surveillance, data sharing, and all of that is happening and happening accurately, effectively, and efficiently to get us as ready as possible?
Well, that's a challenge.
I know the small, I like you the easy ones, Nikki.
So, you know, we have started to tackle this challenge a bit at Brown. This is exactly the thing that concerned me the most when I left the White House, actually. It's the thing that I've decided to kind of throw all of my passion in to while I have time at Brown University. You know, we don't currently have sufficient surveillance or data sharing across the federal government or across the whole United States between the federal government and the states, et cetera. It just, we have systems. CDC is working very hard to have those systems talk to each other, but we're not there yet. We haven't reached a point where I can say that our surveillance system is strong enough to detect the next threat, which is terrifying for all of the things that we've come through and for all the hard work that's been done. It is two steps forward, one step back in a lot of ways when it comes to surveillance, unfortunately. So I've decided that I'm going to really focus on this and see how far I can get this. One of the things I learned when at my work at CDC is data starts in cities, period. You want to get to data, even if you were CDC, no matter what, data starts in cities. You have to work with a city to get what you need in order to move the data forward. All the hard work and data collection, et cetera, happens at the city level first. So, knowing that, we are working on building a surveillance system called BioRadar. The BioRadar system is a system that will detect another novel pathogen. It will detect an accidental, a natural or a deliberate threat. So, what a challenge. So, we have started to tackle this challenge a bit at Brown University, or at least I have. In my brief time at Brown, I have taken with me the biggest fear that I had when I left the White House, which was we actually do not have a biological surveillance system that picks up natural, accidental, or deliberate threats. We have lots of different surveillance systems, both in the federal government, at the state level, and at the city level, but they don't all talk to each other yet. We've worked very hard to get to that place, and we are in a much better place than we were 5 years ago, but we still are not there. And the system that has been created so far, unfortunately, has a very low likelihood of actually detecting any type of new threat, a novel pathogen, and also will not detect biological weapons, which are also a novel pathogen, unfortunately, that has come to be over the last 5 years. So what we are doing is we are starting at the city level. Data starts in cities, so we are starting in cities. We are standing up a surveillance system in 5 to 10 cities across the United States that will encompass three buckets of data, really. Environmental surveillance data, which includes metagenomically sequenced wastewater samples and air samples, clinical and pharmacy data. So that includes data on different patients who have been to hospitals, clinics. This is just anonymous community level data. So, what do I mean by that? Data that is, for instance, counts of people who have been to clinics, urgent cares, to ERs that have been admitted to hospitals, just daily counts and counts of over-the-counter meds and thermometers and prescription meds that have been given out in a day in a specific city. And labs, different lab and blood work that has been given to those individuals, has been taken from those individuals, just anonymized data from what their labs are showing. And the third bucket is social data. So, what's happening on social media in that given day? What type of search trends are we seeing in that given day? What's being generated from our smartphones, from the Google mobility data? What restaurant reservations have been canceled for that day? So, bringing together all of that different surveillance and integrating it will give us a biological profile of a city. So, say, for example, we collect all of that data every day to include seasonality, of course. For Boston, we now have a biological profile, what I like to think of as a biological fingerprint, of what is normal in Boston, no matter the season. So we can see when flu is peaking, we can see when COVID is peaking, we can see all the things we know, right? And then we can also see after we have the normal, just as we do in medicine all the time, after you have the normal, then you can start seeing the abnormal. So, what we're doing is we're integrating all of those different data streams together, creating the profile. And then, with large language modeling and with AI, we will be able to detect the abnormalities that we see. We'll be able to identify the noise, if you will. And we'll be able to create a protocol, which has never been created before, for how do you deal with the noise when you get a bunch of what I like to call unknown unknowns, a pathogen that we have no idea what it is and we've never seen it before, and we can't clearly identify what it is. What do you do when you get that? Well, in this system, there will be a protocol where we work with the city in partnership to figure out how we are going to analyze from all of our data what the unknown unknowns are so that that city can prepare better, so they can prepare their workforce, they can prepare their store shelves, they can prepare their healthcare systems. And beyond that, how private sector can prepare. If an unknown unknown is actually a new novel threat, what can they do? It'll give them a head start to start creating therapeutics and vaccines. And how can we help our global partners? Well, if we see an unknown unknown in wastewater and it happens to have come off of an airplane, where did they see it last? Did the United Kingdom see it? Where was that airplane coming from before the United Kingdom? So we can have contact tracing before it gets here. Or once it arrives, we can figure out how it got here and possibly even attribute who brought it here.
That's really an astounding project. There's so much potential there. And my head is spinning a bit. So congratulations on you for spinning my head. But also it's a great integrated approach and a great way to look at it, how to leverage existing data streams. Again, anonymized, because I'm sure people were thinking, oh, privacy stuff here, but it's all anonymized, to get that larger picture of what's going on. And what immediately came to my mind, aside from I'm going to send you a card, a thank you card for mentioning unknown unknowns. It comes out of our, we use that as well as part of our driving to the knowns process. But the poptalk loop, which we use through meta leadership of what's perceived, let's get that bigger picture. And you're talking about bringing in all these different data streams, everything from what's happening in the healthcare system to restaurant reservation cancellations, those kind of things, bringing it in. Orienting, looking for patterns. What are the patterns here? What's normal? What's abnormal? And then being able to predict based on what you see, what you might be looking at, what might be happening. Is it a spike in a known risk, or is it something novel, the unknown unknown? And then teeing up the decisions people are going to have to make of how do we prepare for this? What do we need to be thinking about and getting ready for it, and so on going through, and then ultimately communicating to the various actors who may be involved in the system, but also to the general public if that's appropriate. So it, what you're doing there is really a comprehensive approach that I would hope would help leaders get ahead of and begin to anticipate what's going to happen. Instead of having to be in reactive mode, you can be much more proactive, which is always good, because if you can get in front of it, you've got a much better job of mitigating risk and getting to the best possible outcome.
That's the dream. I mean, if I learned anything from the last, gosh, however many years, 15 years, I learned that if you can get ahead of it by everything that we've learned, then you're miles ahead of it. Even if you're ahead of it a week or a week and a half, it actually ends up making the biggest difference. If you can alert the right people and have a plan and work your plan that you've had in place already, this isn't the first time and we're not pioneers in this. And if we can just use the tools that we have and bring them all together, and I believe bring them at the city level first together and build from there, I think this really has promise. We learned from COVID about restaurant reservations, and we learned, that your Apple phone or your Apple watches will detect whether you're moving or not. I mean, all of these little bits and pieces we've learned already. We're just putting them all together.
Yeah, no, I recall actually an MPLI project team several years ago in Chicago built an app looking at complaints of bad meals at restaurants on social media, and using that as a way to surveil for foodborne illness. Somebody's saying, "Oh, I ate at X restaurant and I really got sick afterwards." Well, was that just, what was going on there, and looking for patterns? And so I think there's so much data out there that we, as we get the tools to be able to bring in and look at those large volumes of data and figure out where the patterns are, there's so much to be learned there.
Yeah, AI really is the future of detection, I believe. Using it the right way, you can truly, if you have the right systems in place, AI could be, our best friend when it comes to predicting, I
Yes,
hope.
and what and yeah, and getting ahead, as you mentioned, is so important, because once you get behind on one of these things, you never catch up. It's really, really hard. So I have two final questions for you. The first of which is, we're having a hard time recruiting people into public health and into a number of the sort of preparedness response agencies and organizations, because people are tired, and it can be hard to see a future there. But you looked at a quilt that changed your life and changed the trajectory of your life. So what advice would you give to young people? We're recording this actually on the day of Harvard commencement, and we are, and many other schools across the country are bringing fresh new faces into the field. What couple of bits of career advice would you give people in terms of how to make their choices and make the most of the opportunities ahead?
I'm very much a person who I'm driven by passion. I would say if your passion is public health, and if your passion is outbreak response, and if you grew up specifically during this time where you lived through COVID, but through the eyes of someone who was trying to get educated, whether you were in high school or, undergrad at the time, follow the passion that you have in your belly. If it is still public health, if it's global health, do not be discouraged. Hey, I did not get my first job at CDC. I didn't get the second or third either. I won't even tell you how many times I had to apply. Don't get discouraged. Follow your passion. It is the one thing that I have held true to myself, from day one. It's what drives me beyond anything else. And there are ways to make a huge difference in public health and in global health at this time specifically. Don't get distracted by the short-term chaos that you're witnessing right now. In the end, public health will survive because there are so many people who are in it who care more about public health and the safety of people around the world and the health of people around the world than anything else. So just stay true to yourself and follow your passion. And I would say the second piece of advice, which I don't give everyone, but I will give it to these young graduating folks today, is don't be afraid to say yes. I, in my career, have said yes in the middle of the night from random phone calls more than one time. And both of those yeses that people thought were crazy led me to the most incredible experiences at the White House that I've ever had. So think of your life and go forward as a yes person. Don't be afraid of yes. And when you don't know and you're terrified, lean on yes more than no, and it'll land you in a better place.
What a great thought. Don't be afraid to say yes. An opportunity comes knocking, make sure you get up and answer the door. That's and take those chances, because you're right, they can pay off and wind up in amazing experiences and amazing ways to help and fulfill your passion. So my final question is the one I ask all of my guests. What gives you hope?
I just got back from World Health Assembly, and what I witnessed there, you would have thought that the World Health Assembly and at WHO would have been kind of a somber event this year, given the United States pulling out and Argentina following suit. It was the exact opposite. And I left with filled with hope. I got to witness the passion that everybody has that I've been talking about, and how it still is very much alive in the global community. I witnessed unity that I've never seen before. I witnessed African leadership taking stance and saying that they are going to fund their own health for their people. I witnessed hope with the pandemic accord of people actually feeling as though when the next pandemic happens, those who are go with less will not go with less during the next pandemic because of the pandemic accord. And the pandemic accord, I think everybody can agree, is just one baby step forward, and there are about 500 steps after that need to happen. But just the idea of all of the countries getting together, all 193, not the United States, unfortunately, but all of the rest of the countries getting together and deciding to take that baby step forward, that mixed with the African leadership standing up and saying, we're going to do something, we are going to step in and we're going to help our people. I've never seen so much unity. So, watching that, although watching it from the lens of an American who was not a part of a delegation, although it was hard for me because I wasn't a part of it, it gave me hope to know that people are moving on. Unity is happening in ways that we never thought it would happen. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful for public health. I'm hopeful for global health. I'm hopeful that those people and their passion will continue to stand up and make a difference because they care more about that than anything. And they're going to bust through the chaos and they're going to continue to make this work. They're going to find different ways to help people. And if the silver lining of all of this chaos is that we actually now have different mechanisms in place that will help people that need the most help in low and middle income countries, and that will guide them through the next outbreak or pandemic, then I think that's a pretty good silver lining.
And a great note to end on. Thank you so much for sharing your hope, sharing your wisdom, and sharing your experience. It's been a real pleasure to have this conversation.
For me too, Eric. Thank you so much for having me. It's been an
My
honor.
get thank you. My guest for this episode has been Dr. Nikki Romanek, an expert in public health and a distinguished senior fellow in global health security at the Brown University School of Public Health. Until next time, folks, remember your Urit moment can come at any time. Be ready to lead.
This has been another episode of Leader ReadyCast from the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts and find out more about us at npli.sph.harvard.edu. Follow us on Twitter at @HarvardNPLI. Thanks for listening and be ready to lead.